The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Our tech team ensure your broadband runs at its optimum speed. It's all part of the service.
9.30 this Monday morning. Great to have you with us. How was your weekend? That's a rhetorical question, obviously. Billy O'Callaghan, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's very, very nice to talk to you. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks very much for having me on.
No, it's a pleasure. I got up bright and early this morning, made myself a coffee, and I was determined to finish your book, your beautiful book this morning, which I did. Congratulations to you, Billy. It's a marvellous piece of work, I have to say.
Thanks.
Will you do me a favour, Billy, and explain to our listeners this morning what your book is about, Life Sentences.
Right. Well, it's about three generations of an Irish family, my own family. It's based on my grandmother, her father and his mother. And so even though it takes place mostly between about 1910 and 1982, it goes back further, back to sort of the aftermath of the famine. So it spans a fair stretch of time, set around Cork City, Douglas, where I'm living, and West Cork. So, that's basically what it's about.
Yeah, no, that's it. You describe it beautifully. And the way you describe it there in terms of, you talk about the famine, we'll get there in a moment, up to 1982. This book could have been 855 pages long.
I know.
Because that sounds epic. Your book is 200 short pages and just eminently readable pages. Can you talk to me about the brevity of the book before we get into the nitty-gritty?
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, at heart I'm a short story writer.
Okay.
This is my seventh book, but I've written four collections of short stories. So so everything that I start out starts as a short story. Some of them get a bit longer and end up as something else. But that's sort of my touchstone. And so that's probably the reason for the brevity.
Okay, explains it perfectly. Now, you did something really... What I loved about your book was I didn't read anything about it. I love going into it like a blank check and just saying, where is it going to go? So I had no idea, one third of it in, reading about Jerry. So it's just for people, there are three sections. The first section, 1920, Jerry. And then I turn the page and I see, now we're in 1911. So we're back to Nancy. And then we jump to 1982. And that makes great sense when you're reading it. But can I ask you why you flipped the order like that?
Yeah, well, you know, originally, look, I suppose the thing that started this book for me was in my last collection of stories, I had a short story called A Death in the Family, which was a story that my grandmother had told me when I was a very small child, Nelly, in the book. And I had tried my whole life to write that story, that particular story, and it wasn't until about 5 years ago I was, you know, I was good enough, I suppose, to write it. So, but once I wrote that, it sort of opened up the possibilities for this book. Initially, I wrote the juror section, and my intention was only to write that. I was thinking of it in terms of a long short story, but once I was about halfway through, the rest of it started to reveal itself. You know, halfway through juror's section, I mean, you know, the rest of it started to fall into place, and I knew I would have to tell Nancy's story, and Nelly's story. So, I suppose ultimately the book is about family. That's what it's really about for me. And the things that pass between us all. You know, that's maybe genetic memory or whatever you want to call it. But that was the reason. I mean, I didn't set out straight away to write the three sections.
Sure. And that sense of what we call oral history, but coming down through families, is such a, to me, an Irish phenomenon. I'm sure it happens all around the world, but you've You've curated what I think are probably genuine family stories from your past. And that, yeah. Let's talk a bit briefly about that chapter of 1911 and Nancy.
Yeah.
And she'd be, to all intents and purposes, she actually in real life is your great-great-grandmother, would that be right?
That's right, yeah.
So what's so striking about her is in the story, she comes off from an island and gets to Baltimore. But she is full of vivid tales of the aftermath of the Irish famine. And what I loved about this was how close we were in touching distance, generationally, you and me and all of us listening today, to the horrors of a million people dead on the island, a million plus left. But you give us a flavour of it. It actually was tantalising. I wanted more because I felt you write so well. I could really kind of smell the desperation off the page. But did the famine weigh on your mind in terms of you telling that story?
It did. I mean, just before Christmas, the documentary that was on RT, really, I mean, the book was written by then, but, you know, but it brought home just how close it is. Now, a lot of this it's close. I feel it close all the time because when I was a child, I lived with my grandmother, and she would just tell me stories constantly, and that's really what put the seed into me, I suppose, for storytelling. Mm-hmm. But what I remember was that she told me that her grandmother, which would have been Nancy, was a storyteller from West Cork. You know, my grandmother didn't know necessarily specific details, but she remembered her grandmother as a child, and she would have heard, you know, the hardship. Now, I mean, when I look at the whole book, the hardship is evident all the way through, you know, different types of hardship. And, you know, I suppose we have hardship today, but it's not the same magnitude of hardship, you know. There's some bit of a safety net there now. But I think, you know, if you just, as you say, that the famine is so close, we don't realise, you know, we put it out of our heads and we think it's ancient history. But it's only, you know, four or five generations for the likes of us, maybe less for older people. That's very, very close, you know. I met a woman, and she told me that her father was in England, but he was a professor in Oxford, and he had met somebody that had fought in the Crimean War and somebody that had walked on the moon, and it was just a span, you know. Of history in one life. One life touches so, you know, it spans such a wide stretch. So in that sense, you know, to know somebody who knew somebody that had come through the famine, it makes you realise just how close it was, you know.
Yes. And this person, Nancy, she couldn't really, and I'm sure she speaks for so many others in this story, she couldn't shake it. She couldn't shake the hangover of the famine. She couldn't shake the destitution. She couldn't wipe it off her hands like a germ. And she was the life of prostitution, of the workhouses. It just followed her around like a smell. She just couldn't get out of that corner.
Well, you know, I tend to look at it as, you know, the great survivors, because, I mean, they did whatever it took to survive, you know. We saw in that documentary the things they had to eat to survive. You know, we wouldn't, you know, we throw them away as quickly as we can now. And so it was just survival at all costs. That's it. I mean, it must have marked, you know, generations of people.
The book then goes on to talk about Jer, who is the son with his bad temper, but yet he's seen a lot of the world through the army. And then we're into Nellie, his daughter, and we're back now into 1982, and she's looking at what once were fields but are now factories and the Douglas Shopping Centre and Quinsworth and what have you. You know, it's a great span of Irish history. But what I thought about watching, it felt like I was watching a film. I got so lost in your descriptions. I mean, Billy, I really was deeply affected by your book and deeply impressed, if you don't mind me saying so.
I love to hear it.
Yeah, no, but it's true. I just want to tell you to your face rather than say it behind your back.
Yeah.
But what I loved about it throughout was this sense of social history, but dare I say it's social justice, because some people don't get a break. And yes, their lives are not defined by poverty. They're defined by the love they show to their children and their family. But sometimes society won't cut them a chance.
No, that's
right. It's not fair.
Yeah, no, I think you got it. That's what the book is about. It's, you know, the thing that matters over everything in this book is family. It's everything is done for the sake of family.
Yeah.
You know, the things that Nancy had to do in her life, they were done for the benefit of her children.
Yeah.
That, you know, and I mean, that's even, there's a section at the end of Jer's part which tells that after his sister has died, Jer's brother-in-law is going to take the children to England. And, you know, I don't want to say too much about what goes on with them, but Nancy goes with them to rear the children. Because, you know, even to that stage, it's selfless. You know, it's because she knows that the children need her. She doesn't put herself first in any situation. So, I just think that's the crux of the book, really, is the love of family.
You,
most important thing.
You describe there's a piece I'm going to read briefly, if I may, which describes. Losing somebody very close to you. And I think it's very pertinent to where we are as a country at the moment because of what's happening in the world.
Yeah.
And trying to make sense of death, particularly premature death. I'm even talking to Barry McGuigan on Friday night. He still haunts my thoughts this morning because of the raw grief that can happen, especially if you're predeceased by a child, which is, of course, so wrong. But anyway, back to your book and this section, this little paragraph, if I may indulge, is Nellie speaking in 1982. And she said, maybe there's some truth to the notion of time's healing qualities. But there's also no denying that life occasionally breaks in ways that can't be mended. We watch and wait and squeeze the hands of our dying, trying to comfort them when there's nothing left to say. And then we put them in the ground, weep a while for them and for ourselves. And when enough time has passed, because we have no other choice, we search among the fragments of whatever remains to us for a reason to keep moving forwards. And then we step back into a world that, indifferent to our tribulations, has continued all the while to turn. And we go on breathing until our own air runs out. And there's no real getting over those kinds of losses, the death of a spouse or a child, but they must be borne. And of course, the losses I've endured are not unique. I mean, even at the end of her reflections on death and sadness, she's still saying, but don't mind me, like I'm one of many.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is, you know, this is everyone's story in a sense, because it's these are ordinary people. You know, I mean, there was a lot of what's in the book is based on things that were told to me. But there were things that were put into the book that were based on research as well. It was my sister Irene and her friend Yen that did a lot of the research, because I'm useless with the computer. You know, they found a lot of the information about Nancy, which I would never have been able to find.
Did they dig into? Sorry to cut across. I just found your descriptions, and they're brief because the book is brief. But there's part of me was. I'll come back to that in a sec. The descriptions of the workhouses. You don't get into them in any great deal, other than there's a kind of an innuendo or nuance to what may or may not have an implication, if you like, and the desperation of being there and the cruelty of the father of her children kind of almost mocking her for having to go in there. Is that where the research was helpful to you?
That's exactly where it did come from. You know, there are things that are only touched on and are not developed, the workhouse. And I wanted it to be one of those things you couldn't even face, you know, that for herself. I mean, if she's telling her story, this is something that she doesn't want to talk about, or she's not able to go into it in, you know, in enough detail. So, you know, I think there, you know, the things that we block out that we don't want to deal with. So that's the reason why certain things are only touched on. Yeah. And kind of passed over. But yeah, I mean, the research was, you know, that was the hardest part of it, really, was not for me, it was for my sister and yeah. a friend. But we really struggled to find Ger's birth records, because there was no record of him in the parish, and we didn't know that he'd been born in the workhouse. So it was just on a hunch that they had, that they went looking for workhouse records, which were kept in, there's an archive in Blackrock in Cork City, mm-hmm. Blackpool in Cork City. And they found, I went with them one morning, and we went through these microfilm records, and up it popped Ger's record, and then his sister's record as well, Mamie. And it gave us shocking detail which we hadn't expected to find, mm. And so that was the thing. That this was ever before. I mean, this was a few years before I had started writing the book. It was at that point that side of it started to form for me, mm. that I could find some kind of a narrative to tell her story. But yeah, so it's a mixture of stories that were told to me and research. So.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And you know, I was reading it over the weekend, and the events of the last week in Ireland. I'm thinking of your mother. You must have been thinking the same thing when you.
I was, of course.
And here's what crossed my mind, and Billy, I might be overstating the case, but you know, this country has this peculiar. A thing about institutions,
yeah,
and putting people who don't
belong,
don't suit the national narrative, to use
that's
the
right.
term,
yeah.
And they say, do you know what? We lash them in there because that's not really helping who the image of who we are. Workhouses, get them in there. I mean, Victorian,
yeah, no, that's right.
You know, and then the mother and baby homes and county homes, get them out of the way, get them in
yeah.
there. And you could argue that so yeah. that we're not so supercilious as a generation. You no. could argue that in 20 years' time, our kids will be looking at us saying, lads, did you not see the direct provision centres? No.
Yeah,
did,
I know.
Did you not see what was going on in there and the treatment of people and the poverty and again, get them out of the way.
Yeah, no, we have, you know, we have, I hate to say it, but this is one of the dark parts of our history. We throw people away that we don't find a use for, I think.
Yeah.
We try to. Some years ago, I wrote a short story. I won't go on too long about it, but yeah. I wrote a story, and I had gone up to the Connemara National Park, and I didn't realise it until I went in the gates of the place that it was letter freck.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I'd been working on a story because. My father had grown up around farms, and he told me that there were a lot of farmers' men that had been taken out of orphanages as boys and basically just used as like slave labour on the farms mm. for their whole lives. And so I had written this story, and it was, I was very happy with the story. The story was called Farmed Out. And a few years after I had written it, I was out in China. The book was, the collection of stories was translated into Chinese, and I met the publishers, and that was the story they wanted to talk about, this story Farmed Out. Yeah. They said, well, why did you write this? And I said, you know, this is one of our great shames, you know, this is one of the things that really, you know, shame us as a country. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh yeah, for us it's the Cultural Revolution, you know. They told me stories that would put the hair standing on your head.
Mm. Yeah, because we can be hard on ourselves, and rightly so,
yeah.
but we're not the only country in the world to have national shame. Billy, I have to say, a lot of love coming into you for your previous book, My Coney Island Baby. And with that in mind, people like Anne-Marie and Laura and Mairead in Tipperary are all saying the same thing, that they can't wait for this book because they loved that book so much. So that's good news.
Wonderful.
And so that's good news. I think that your book belongs to the kind of school of writing that people who read Sebastian Barry, Donal Ryan, I would say Liam O'Flaherty, will really love. And I really, really got, I was lost in your words. It's my book of the year so far.
Oh, you're very kind.
It's not February yet, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've read a few already. No, but it's great. And what I'm so happy is, because I'm so lost in Iceland in my reading, and it was so lovely to drift back home to Ireland with a great writer. And whatever you're doing, keep doing. I would love you to write a similar book just based purely in some aspect of famine Ireland. I would love you to take on the mantle of Walter Macken and Liam O'Flaherty and go there and get busy and get your sister busy with the homework, and then you can knock the ball into the back of the net. Billy, congratulations.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Ryan.
It's been really good to talk. I hope to meet you in due course when this all settles down.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on.
Not at all. I'm delighted for you and your success, and thanks for bringing that book into our world.
Okay, thank you.
All the best.
Bye now.
Thank you. That's Billy O'Callaghan. And in case you didn't know, I like this book a lot. It's called Life Sentences. And what you do now is you go online to your local bookshop or call them, and they'll put a copy aside for you at the end of the week, and then you'll have it for the weekend and you'll be made up, I can assure you. Right, loads coming in on everything. We'll come to it after this.